Lecture 7 of the Standard Model course. So today we're going to do the spontaneous symmetry breaking of the Standard Model. We're going to begin by doing it in a sort of simple case, and then discuss the more general case, and then apply it to the Standard Model in particular. So it'll probably bleed over into the next lecture, because once the application of the Standard Model involves some subtle points. So here we're going to first review spontaneous symmetry breaking of a global symmetry, in which case the key thing we want to meet is sort of Goldstone's theorem. And then we'll do the gauge case where the broken symmetry is a gauge symmetry, in which case Goldstone's theorem turns into the Higgs mechanism. Let's get started. So let's consider, again, let's just start out by considering the spontaneous symmetry breaking in the simplest case. And also in the case where it's a global symmetry. Okay, so let's consider our old friend the action for a single complex scalar field. Okay, not a gauge theory yet. And then minus V of phi. And I'll take this potential to be this form, where it has an unstable quadratic term. So first it turns down, and then a stable quartic term, which turns it back up. Okay, so again, this potential looks like it goes down first and then back up. And if this is the this axis and this axis are the complex phi plane, and this whole thing is symmetric in the complex phi plane, and it has a ring of minima here, which also form a circle in the complex phi plane. Okay, I'm not sure, that's not a great drawing, but so this is supposed to look like the bottom of a wine bottle, and this is the circle where the wine bottle hits the table, and this is supposed to be where I've chopped off the wine bottle at some point. Okay. Yeah, it's a bad drawing. What can I say? But this theory has a global U1 symmetry in the sense that the action is invariant if I send phi to e to the I alpha phi, some arbitrary complex phase, e to the I alpha, as long as I make sure that alpha is independent of space-time, just a constant. Okay, great. So we want to, first of all, find the vacua of this theory. So what do we mean by the vacua? Well, we just mean the solutions of the equation of motion that have the lowest energy. Okay, so okay, fine. So if to find the equations of motion, we would vary S with respect to phi. So we'll get So phi is a complex scalar field, so it's, you can think of it as either two real scalar fields. Phi is equal to 1 over root 2, phi 1 plus I phi 2. Or, conveniently, hopefully you've seen this before, but let me make sure. Another way to look at this is that you can do a change of basis, and instead of working with these two real fields, you can work with phi and its complex conjugate, phi bar, which is then phi 1 minus I phi 2. And the point is that phi and phi bar can be treated as the two independent fields instead of phi 1 and phi 2. And so the derivative of phi with respect to phi bar, if you use the fact that the derivative with respect to phi 1 with respect to phi 2 vanishes, and vice versa, and use the chain rule, you'll find that the derivative of phi with respect to phi bar vanishes, and vice versa. So we can treat them as two independent fields, and that's a convenient thing to do when you're dealing with a complex, that's always a convenient thing to do when you're dealing with a field that depends on complex fields, with an action that depends on complex fields. Okay, so actually let's vary this with, so in other words, we have a choice now. We can either vary the action with respect to phi or with respect to phi dagger. Let's vary it with respect to phi dagger. Okay, so then this becomes partial mu of d phi dagger. We do get a variation in the first term, but in the second factor there's nothing. So the second factor is just d mu phi. And then the potential, we get dv d phi dagger delta of phi dagger. And then if we integrate by parts here, and throw away the boundary term, this becomes d mu of phi minus d nu d phi dagger, and I'll pull the delta phi daggers outside. Okay, great. And so then, so for this variation to vanish, I need this thing to vanish. And so the equation of motion for a scalar field is d mu phi is equal to partial nu partial phi dagger. Okay, great. So that's the complex Klein-Gordon equation. So then, so that's the equation of motion we want the vacuum to satisfy. On the other hand, we want it to be the minimum energy solution. So for that, we want to find the corresponding energy, the expression for the energy. So we do that in the usual way. If we write this as d4x times the Lagrangian density, then we can construct the momenta conjugate. So we have our two variables, phi and phi dagger. The first thing we do is we construct their conjugate momenta. So pi sub phi would be partial L partial phi dot. And so that this thing is equal to d4x times the Lagrangian density. Okay, so this is phi dagger dot. And similarly, the momentum conjugate to phi dagger is partial L partial phi dagger dot, and that would be phi dot. Okay, so fine. So then, as usual, once we have the Lagrangian density, we can form the Hamiltonian density from it by taking each variable times its conjugate momentum, so phi times pi sub phi minus phi dagger times phi, sorry, plus pi times plus phi dagger, So as usual, we can take, you know, the Hamiltonian is Q dot P minus the Lagrangian. So for each variable, we take that variable dot times its conjugate momentum. So we do that for both of our variables here, and then we subtract the Lagrangian density, and we get, in this case, if you just work it through, phi dot dagger phi dot plus grad phi dagger grad phi, and now we have plus the potential d of phi. Okay, and then the energy is just the integral of this over space. Okay, great. So if we want to find the minimum, we want to find the solutions of the equations of motion that minimize this thing. Well, let's first look for the minimum of this guy. So at its minimum, you know, if we look for the extrema of this guy, those are the points where dv d phi and dv d phi dagger both vanish. Okay, so dv d phi, again, treating phi and phi dagger as independent variables here, we would get minus m squared phi dagger, and then plus lambda over 2 phi dagger phi times phi dagger. And we would simplify all of that to just put it in the form minus m squared plus lambda over 2 phi dagger phi, and then I just pulled an overall phi dagger out to one side. And then this is just the complex, this will just turn out to be the complex conjugate of that equation. So this guy will just be minus m squared plus lambda over 2 phi dagger phi, and times phi. Okay, and we want those both to be zero. So, well, we see there's two different ways to make these both zero. Either we can take phi equals zero, so we can either take phi equals zero, which corresponds to sitting at the middle of the potential there, but of course that's, we see from the picture there, that's not a minimum. And the other way we can do it is by making the terms in square brackets vanish. So in other words, we could take phi dagger phi, we could set m squared equal to lambda over 2 phi dagger phi, or in other words, phi dagger phi is equal to 2m squared over lambda, if I haven't messed up my algebra. And okay, these are actually where the minima are. Okay. So that this minimizes the potential term in the Hamiltonian. We have the kinetic term and the potential term in the Hamiltonian there. We've minimized the potential term. Of course, the way to minimize the kinetic term is to just take phi to be also a constant. So phi satisfies this and is constant everywhere in space. It doesn't move around the circle in space. And then we just have to check, okay, would that would certainly minimize that expression, but is it a solution of the equation of motion, the Klein-Gordon equation there? Well, yes, it is, because if it's a constant, then the left-hand side of the equation of motion vanishes. On the other hand, the right-hand side of the equation of motion vanishes, because that was one of the partial v partial phi dagger equals zero was one of the conditions we needed to derive this equation. Good. So the vacua are the set of constant field the solutions that are constant in spacetime and satisfy this equation. And a key point is just that because the original theory had a U1 symmetry, under this, that the set of vacua form a, we don't get a unique vacuum. Instead, we get a manifold of different possible vacua, because for every one value of phi, that constant value of phi that minimizes the energy, you know, e to the I alpha times that, any other point on that minimum circle also works. And so we get a so-called vacuum manifold. Or moduli space of vacua. Which in this case is just a circle. Okay. Good. So let's now the idea is that the field in the real world will be sitting in its lowest energy configuration. Well, which lowest energy configuration? There's no way to pick one. We just pick one by one of them. And so that arbitrary choice of which of the vacua the actual universe sits in is so-called spontaneous symmetry breaking. But let's imagine that the field is sitting in that vacuum, and try to do quantum field theory, try to analyze what is the spectrum of particles and interactions we would see as a low energy observer in that theory. Okay, so what we should do is we should take our original field phi and split it into this constant part. Okay, by convention, it's good. It's usually when you convert from, I'm gonna convert for this next part of the discussion from talking about one complex scalar field to two real scalar fields. And when you do that, usually you, there's conventional 1 over root 2 that comes into the change of variables. So that's what that guy is. So let's write this as a constant part plus, so this constant part is sitting right at the bottom of our potential here. Okay, so, whoops, wrong one. Okay, so this constant here, I will be calling 1 over square root 2 v. And then the real field which perturbs me away from this vacuum point in the radial direction, well, that's going to be because I've chosen my field to be this real value. I've chosen this particular point on the circle at the right side here in the picture. So the radial field variable will be a real field chi 1. And the other field, which takes me in the perpendicular, the circumferential direction, what I mean to say is in the tangential direction to the sphere, is then going to be an imaginary field. So this would be I times the real field chi 2. Okay, so with our previous, I want to write this as 1 over root 2, the VEV, plus chi 1, plus I chi 2. Where, okay, this is, the VEV V is supposed to be the constant part when these fluctuations are 0. So if we set these to 0 and plug this thing in here, plug this thing in here, we see that V, you know, we get V squared over 2 here. So that's saying that V squared is equal to 4 m squared over lambda, or in other words, that the radius of that circle after we take the root 2 out is 2m over the square root of lambda. Okay, so now we want to just plug this thing in. So now this thing we're going to just treat like a constant, just like any other coupling constant in the potential. And then these are the fields, and we want to plug this expression into that action and see what it becomes when written in terms of the fields chi 1 and chi 2, which are actually the displacements around the physical vacuum. Okay, and so there's a little exercise that I recommend doing, but won't do on the board. It's quite straightforward to do, which is you just plug this expression in there and begin to expand it out. And then let's just look at the part that is, I'm only going to write explicitly the terms up to quadratic order in the fields and throw everything else. Everything else will be the interaction terms. They'll give me the vertices in my Feynman diagrams. But all the terms involving three or more fields I won't write explicitly here, because in terms of determining what are the physical particles in the theory, it's the quadratic part that we look at. Okay, so if we plug this in, what happens? Well, so first of all, if we plug this into the kinetic term, you see the potential. If we look at partial mu of phi, the partial mu will kill this part and keep these guys. And then because we have partial mu phi dagger times partial mu phi, one term will come with a chi 1 plus I chi 2. The other one will come with a chi 1 minus I chi 2. So the cross terms will vanish. And so as our kinetic terms here, we'll just get d mu chi 1 squared minus d mu chi 2 squared. And then what about when we plug this guy into the potential? Well, here's the bit I'm not going to do explicitly, but it's a straightforward expression to plug this into that there. And so what do we get? Well, the key thing is that first we get a constant term, a term that involves none of the fields, okay, which is m to the fourth over lambda. Okay, now remember this is minus the potential energy. This is minus the potential energy. So this is a negative constant of potential energy. Well, that makes sense because that's saying that that's just saying that if this is zero energy, well, that's not the vacuum. The vacuum is down here at some negative energy. And what's the value of that negative energy filling space? It's that distance there, which is m squared over lambda. So this is, there's negative a vacuum energy of minus m squared over lambda. I have major board coordination issues. And then, okay, then if we look, the terms that are linear in the fields, chi 1 and chi 2, vanish. We had arranged that to happen when we chose a point on the potential where both of the partials of the potential vanished. So now we get to the terms quadratic in chi 1 and chi 2. Well, we find that there's only a term for chi 1. Okay. So there's a term that's minus m squared times chi 1 squared, but then there's nothing for chi 2. There's 0 times chi 2 squared. Okay, and then there's also some terms that are interaction terms. Okay, there's a potential for chi 1 and chi 2, but these are all terms that are cubic or quartic in the fields chi 1 and chi 2. So to determine what the physical spectrum of particles in theory is, we look at the quadratic part. And so what does this say? It says that chi 1 has a normal kinetic term and a normal mass term. If you look at the normal action for a real scalar field, it's usually normalized as minus 1/2 times the kinetic term like this, and then minus 1/2 mu squared chi 1 squared. That would be the normal way to write the mass term, or if it had a mass chi, if it had a mass mu. And so comparing these two, we see that actually the mass of this particle, chi 1, has a mass which is given by root 2 times the original parameter m that appeared in the Lagrangian. And then chi 2 has zero mass. So chi 2 is massless. And this appearance of a massless scalar particle when you spontaneously break, this is called the Goldstone boson. This massless boson that appeared when we spontaneously broke a global symmetry is called the Goldstone boson. And so we'll talk a little bit later in the lecture about what, when we go beyond the simplest case and you break a more complicated symmetry, a more complicated scalar field, what Goldstone bosons do you expect? But for now, I just want to emphasize that the basic idea that you can see it here. The mass of the particle is the curvature of the potential. So if we're perturbing about this point in the potential, the vacuum, well, the real field, which points along this direction, it does have a positive curvature in its potential, so it has a positive mass. But this guy, chi 2, which points in the tangential direction, the potential is completely flat in that direction. It has no curvature. that guy is massless. And so that's what always, you know, in when you have a more general potential, you know, the manifold and the vacuum, instead of being a circle like it is here, it might be a sphere or some fancier manifold. But the point is that the scalar fields that point along that sphere, that carry you along that vacuum manifold, those will be massless and will be the so-called Goldstone bosons. The rest of the scalar fields in the theory, which carry you off the vacuum manifold, like the radial direction does here, will be massive. Okay, so now let's, so much for the simple global example. Now it's easy to do the corresponding corresponding story with gauge symmetry and see how it changes. Now's probably as good a time as ever to pause. Any volunteers to perform for us, tap dance, or, oh yes, thank you, my friend.
So I got my limerick from a couple days ago, needed a sequel.
Yeah, oh, I thought so too, but I didn't want to put too much pressure on you.
Yeah. So starting out with two more stanzas. Maybe I'll review the first one. Okay, so Einstein was up in a tree. He was looking as smug as can be. When someone asked why, he said, "I'm a pie, so time passes faster for me." People came from miles around to see Einstein in the tree. And when they came, they gathered around to see why this could be. They pestered him with questions, but all they heard him cry was, "I cannot tell what you are saying. Your redshift's way too high."
I mean, to complain that it's not quite a limerick would seem to be in bad taste. What it is a pure piece of genius of its own type. Another, it's just great. Thank you very much. Okay, well that saves me from my. That's good. Wow, that was so good. I forgot what I was going to say. So we're going on now except to say keep them coming. I mean, obviously, you know, if you have more stanzas in you, yeah. I mean, if it could all be this one poem, that would be. Yeah. That could be too much to ask, maybe.
A saga.
Yeah, a saga, exactly. That's right. If it was all the same poem and he never came down out of the tree, that would be a level of technical achievement that, well, we'll see. I don't know. I mean, what can I say? Your potential seems high. Okay, so to continue, let's gauge the U1 in the previous example. Okay, good. So we know how to turn a theory with a global symmetry into a gauge symmetry. We did this already. So we're just going to replace the partial derivative with the appropriate covariant derivative. We don't need to change the potential at all. And then we are going to write down the kinetic term for the gauge field in the usual way. And so again, this is just, so now the symmetry is just a U1 gauge symmetry, so this complex field phi of x will go to the e to the I alpha of x, which can now be a function of spacetime, times phi of x. And so since this is just a simple U1 theory, this f mu nu is just a simple, ordinary simple U1 expression. It's just partial mu a nu minus partial nu a nu. Okay, so we can repeat our earlier logic. The first thing we want to do is find the vacua of these theories, of this theory. So we could derive the equation of motion. Now we would perturb with respect to phi, or phi dagger, to get the equation of motion for phi. And we would perturb with respect to A to get the equation of motion for A. And we want a solution that satisfies both of those equations. And on the other hand, we can do the same thing. We can calculate the Hamiltonian here and we want a solution that satisfies the equation's motion and minimizes the energy. Well, it turns out that the solution will just be, I mean, if you work it through, it'll just be that you can take the gauge field to be zero, in which case you minimize the energy in the electric and magnetic fields. They're both zero. And then once it's zero, everything about the equations for the scalar field are the same as they were before. And so we'll end up getting the same solutions as we had before, that phi is a constant satisfying this same constraint. Where is it? I lost it, but that, oh yeah, this guy. Okay, so that's our vacuum. Those are, again, we have this manifold, we have this basically the same manifold of vacua that we had before. And so as before, we just want to take, we just want to take this same expression and now plug it into that action. Okay, so what changes when we do this? Well, nothing changes here. This term is exactly the same, but the kinetic term changes. Okay, so now if we look at d mu of phi and expand out what that looks like, well, this is partial mu plus ig a mu, and then times 1 over root 2 v plus chi 1 plus I chi 2. Okay, so now, again, the name of the game when we're trying to analyze the spectrum of particles in the theory is to isolate the quadratic part of the Lagrangian, the part of the Lagrangian involving at most two fields, two powers of any field, and throw everything else away. And so in particular, in the kinetic term, we want to do that. So if we expand this out, well, partial mu annihilates v, but doesn't annihilate these guys. So we get 1 over root 2 partial mu chi 1 plus I partial mu chi 2. Okay. And then now if we take this term and multiply it times these guys, we get ig a mu times v. Then we in principle get two more terms, a mu times chi 1 and a mu times I chi 2, but those terms are already quadratic in the fields because they involve the power of this field A times chi 1 or chi 2. So when we square this thing, those are going to inevitably give rise to terms that, you know, so if we include, there's two more terms here, but since they're both quadratic in the fields, when we square this whole expression, these things will only appear in terms that are cubic or higher. So interaction terms we don't care about. So we don't need those. Good. So now we want to take, so this is the expression for d mu phi. We want to take this times its dagger. And well, this has the form x plus iy here. You know, this is 1 over root 2 x plus iy, where x is this real part, partial mu of chi 1. And iy is I times, well, there's two i's appearing here. So y is partial mu of chi 2 plus gv a mu. So when we square this, it'll be 1 half x squared plus y squared. So that is to say, when we expand out the kinetic term here, it will be minus 1 half times the square of the real part, d mu chi 1 squared, and then plus the square of the imaginary part, which is d mu chi 2 plus g v a mu squared. Okay, so now the key point is that I want to, let me redefine the thing inside the parentheses here. I'll call that whole thing. So this is g v a mu plus some stuff. I'm going to absorb that extra stuff into a redefinition of A mu. So I'll call this whole, I'll redefine that whole thing to be GV times A mu Twiddle. Okay. So what's the point of that? Well, if we now continue expanding out the quadratic part here, what do we get? Well, we get the kinetic term for. Did I mess something up?
Sorry, we had a question.
Yes, yes.
Are you just saying that if you chose A mu to be zero, then you get the same as before? Because otherwise, there would be no A terms.
So if you were think back about what we did over here. So first I looked for the vacuum piece. And then after I had found the vacua, I went back and rewrote the fields as I rewrote the full non-vacuum field as the vacuum part plus some extra bit. So over here, the vacuum pieces are zero and non-zero. But now I'm doing like I did before. Now I'm going back and dealing with the full Lagrangian. It's just that I'm rewriting the fields as perturbations around their vacuum value. So in the case of A, I don't actually have to do anything different because I'm just perturbing around zero, which is what I was doing before. So I'm back to, I found these constant solutions of the equation to motion, which minimize the energy. But then I'm not going to restrict the action to those constant solutions. I'm back to thinking about the general solution of the fields can be anything, but I'm going to rewrite this expression by re-expressing the fields as deviations away from their vacuum solutions. So in particular for the field phi, that means I have to do this thing where I write it as, since it does have some non-zero shift in its vacuum value away from zero, I have to write it as the vacuum piece plus some other stuff. For A, in principle, I'm doing the same thing. I'm writing it as its vacuum value plus some new field A mu prime. But yeah, I should have explained this better. But since this is zero in the vacuum, really there's no difference between A mu and A mu prime. So I'm just dropping the prime. And that's why A mu is zero over here. But it's not zero again when it appears in this expression, because here I'm expanding out the general action. Okay. So we're expanding out the kinetic term. We get this minus 1/2 d mu chi 1 squared, the kinetic term for chi 1. The next term we get is minus 1/2 gv squared times a twiddle mu squared. So much for the, and then plus, you know, again, I forgot to write here, but if we really squared this thing and included these other bits, there would be plus interaction terms here, cubic and higher terms coming from these guys. Okay, so much for the kinetic term. Then for the potential terms, that's what we get instead of this and this. And then the rest of this, the potential terms are the same as before. So we have plus m squared, m to the fourth over lambda, minus the mass term for chi 1. And then finally, okay, so now we've dealt with everything except for this guy. Well, now we notice that actually, f mu nu squared is equal to f mu nu twiddle squared. Because, so in other words, if we define f mu nu twiddle in the analogous way, by partial mu a twiddle nu minus partial nu a twiddle mu. Well, okay, so a nu twiddle is just a nu, and then plus a piece which is proportional to partial nu of chi 2. Maybe I'll just write it out to be clear. D mu, so this is a nu, and then plus something like 1 over gv partial mu, partial nu of chi 2, because chi, in other words, this correction term here, and then minus b nu times a mu plus 1 over gv of partial mu of chi 2. Okay, but since the partials commute, this is chi 2 times partial mu partial nu, this is minus partial nu partial mu times chi 2, so these terms cancel each other, and this is just our previous expression for f mu nu. Okay, so now let's look at what we've got. We've got an overall constant negative vacuum energy. We have our scalar field chi 1, just like before, which is a massive scalar field. This is the field that moves us in the radial direction. And then, now, instead of a Goldstone boson, we don't see the scalar field chi 2 anywhere. But instead, what we have now is this action, which is minus a quarter times a Maxwell term, f mu nu squared, and then minus a half times something times the gauge field explicitly squared. Well, that is nothing but the action for a massive vector boson. So if you set this to zero, that's the standard action for a massless vector boson. But when you include this guy, that's exactly the mass term for that vector boson. So that is the Higgs mechanism. Okay? So the Higgs mechanism is what just happened. Which is that when you break a global symmetry, you get some Goldstone bosons, some massless scalar fields running around in the theory. Now, we don't see any massless scalar fields running around in nature, so it seems like the fundamental laws of physics do not involve the spontaneous breaking of a global symmetry, at least nothing exact, because we don't see any exactly massless scalar fields, as far as we know. But if now, when we gauge the symmetry, what happens instead is that every Goldstone scalar field, everything that had previously been a Goldstone boson, each real scalar field that was previously massless, gets eaten. For some reason, this is standard notation, standard terminology. It gets eaten by one of the corresponding, in a sense I'll describe in a minute, gauge field. Okay, and this guy used to be massless, but now it ate a scalar field and became massive. Okay, so in particular, the massless, you hopefully learned in your QFT class, maybe you did or maybe you didn't, but a massless vector field in four dimensions, you know, it naively looks like it has four components, but secretly, because of gauge invariance, it only has two polarizations. So this is like the fact that a photon can be left polarized or right polarized, and there's no other physical options for it. But this guy, a mu twiddle, a massive vector field has three polarizations. A massive field of spin S always has polarizations running from minus S plus one, up to plus S. So polarizations running in integer units from minus S to plus S. These are the different spin states of a massive spin S field. And so if S is one, this is a vector boson has spin one, this goes from minus one, zero, plus one. So there's three polarizations. And so we have this process that happened, which is that in the original theory, we had a complex scalar field, which was basically two real degrees of freedom, chi one and chi two. And then plus we had a massless vector field, which was another two real degrees of freedom because it has two real polarizations. But then after spontaneous symmetry breaking, we ended up with just our only scalar field left in the theory was chi one. So that's just one real degree of freedom. And this guy becomes a massive vector boson, which has three real degrees of freedom, three polarizations. So the number of degrees of freedom, okay, this is, and again, this whole process is called the Higgs mechanism. That because we've taken the Goldstone boson here and incorporated it, it's been eaten by the vector boson. It looks like the number of scalar fields has changed and the number of vector fields degrees of freedom have changed, but the total number of bosonic degrees of freedom is four here and it's still four here. So no actual real degrees of freedom have vanished. That would be a problem. But the interpretation has changed, that a thing that we used to call a scalar degree of freedom over here has migrated and become a polarization of the vector field over here. And just to say, just to explain a little bit better what I mean by that. So this new third polarization is exactly this piece. So we had our previous vector field, massless vector field A nu, and then now A nu twiddle has this extra contribution, 1 over gv times partial nu of the scalar field chi 2. Well, if this term wasn't present, then this would be exactly, adding this term would be exactly a gauge transformation. That's exactly what a gauge, you know, in a U1 gauge theory, if you take A nu and you add to it something which is just the partial derivative of a scalar field, well, then F squared is left invariant. And if this was the only term here, that would mean that would be a symmetry of the action. And this would be a completely unphysical transformation. This would be a pure gauge transformation. But now that we've added a mass term, this making this change is not a symmetry of the action because this term does change when we shift A to A plus this. So it's no longer a symmetry of the action. This is an actual physical degree of freedom. This is exactly the new third polarization of the vector field which appears. Okay. So that's how it works in the simplest case. And now let's just see, it's kind of, now we can, well, I'll say it. Now we can say how it will go in the general case. So, imagine now, in the more general case, we've just been dealing with an abelian gauge theory with gauge group U1, and the scalar field was just a single complex number over each point in space. But now we want to generalize that to more general non-abelian gauge theories, and in particular in the standard model. So let's let phi now be, you know, an r-dimensional vector of scalar fields. Okay, it's going to transform in the so let's say I'll call it phi sub r to remind you that it's an r component vector. So it transforms in the R dimensional. It transforms as the R dimensional representation of some non-abelian group G. This was U1 before, but now it's something else. Okay, so it will transform under a gauge transformation like phi R goes to some representation matrix, some R by R matrix times phi R. Okay, that will be that the idea is that that's a symmetry of the theory. And okay, so but we can write this thing, remember, as exponential of I times the sum of coefficients lambda A times the Lie algebra generators T sub A or T super A. And again, we're in the R by R representation. So these are the R by R representations. These are each T sub A here is an R by R matrix. Okay, so just to be again clear, because this is always a point that everyone gets confused about. So the R is the dimension of the representation, but the Lie algebra has some other dimension, which is just determined by the Lie algebra itself. And that's the number of values through which A runs. So let's say that the Lie algebra is a vector space V. These TAs are the basis vectors for that vector space. And let's say it's D dimensional, that vector space. So in other words, A, the index A runs from 1 to D. Okay. So, sorry, just to finish the expression here, this is G is E to the I times that, acting on our R component vector phi R. And then let's just look at infinitesimal transformations here. Sorry, that's supposed to be a wiggly equal sign. So that's 1 plus I lambda A T A R by R acting on phi R. Okay. Now, again, these TAs are the basis vectors for some vector space. Now, there is some subspace of this vector space which, when it acts on phi r, annihilates it, okay? So this is how the general field transforms. Now let's imagine let's look at the vacuum expectation value of the field. Okay, well it transforms just like everything else. Okay, so the VEV transforms like this. Okay, so now we pick a particular VEV, and we ask, of this vector space of transformation, of R by R transformation matrices, let's look at the sub, there may be some subspace, W, okay, of dimension let's say K, which is less than or equal to D, because this is some subspace of our original vector space V. There's a subspace with the property that lambda A TA acting on the VEV here vanishes. Okay, so in the general case, what we'll find is that this subspace of the original Lie algebra will generate a subgroup of the original Lie group, which is unbroken when the field gets a VEV. Okay, so the field gets a VEV, and in our previous example, we started with such a small symmetry, U1, that when we gave the field a VEV, the symmetry was completely destroyed. There was nothing left. But in general, in more general case, when we give the field a VEV, we'll find that some of the symmetry remains. It's not broken by the VEV, and some of it is broken. Okay, so the subspace of the Lie algebra that annihilates the VEV is the part that is unbroken. So so the exponential of this Lie algebra will continue to be a symmetry of the theory, will continue to look like an unbroken gauge symmetry to the low energy observer perturbing around the BEV. On the other hand, the quotient space of V by W, so this is another vector space which has dimension D minus K. So these are the transformations that don't leave the BEV invariant. So maybe it'll be helpful to draw a picture. See, in my previous picture, because I can only draw in three dimensions, I reserved one direction for the value of the potential, and I used the other two for the field values. And so the biggest vacuum manifold that I could draw was this one-dimensional circle. And in that case, the generators, the only generator that we have here is one of the generators that I would associate with V mod W. It changes as we do a U1 transformation, it moves us around the circle. It doesn't leave the vacuum invariant. If we want to visualize the other type of generator, let's take all three directions to be, let's imagine we have a slightly bigger field space now. Suppose that the potential has three scalar fields, and these are just, I'm drawing the fields along these three directions, phi one, phi two, and phi three. Okay, and imagine that the potential for these three real scalar fields is a SO3 invariant. So now, you know, the potential still has a local maximum at the origin, and then as we move out, the potential goes down, and then at some sphere it reaches a minimum, and then it begins to come back up again. Okay, so in other words, there's some sphere here on which the potential is minimized. And now suppose the BEV is some particular point here. And now we ask, well, what are the original symmetries of the theory? Well, they're SO3. There's three different generators. So for example, in SO3, we have to pick it's a three-dimensional group. So two dimensions go toward picking the direction we want to rotate around. And then the third generator tells us how much to rotate around, rotates us around that fixed direction. So suppose this is our BEV here. Well, two of the generators of SO3 will move us away from this BEV. They will either rotate, they would rotate the BEV this way, or they would rotate it this way out of the page. And those two guys, each of those two guys, if it was a global symmetry, each of those two guys would correspond to a Goldstone boson. So in this case, there would be two Goldstone bosons, one scalar field which parameterize motions along this direction, where the potential is flat, so it has zero mass. One which parameterizes motion along this direction, where the potential is again flat, so it has zero mass. There would be a third scalar field which parameterizes motion in the radial direction. And that guy, since the potential is dropping, 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 and then growing, 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 the potential is not flat as we move in the radial direction around this point. So this guy, the radial scalar field, does have a non-zero mass. So in this case, we have one massive and two massless scalars. Now, when we do a gauge transformation, now when we gauge the symmetry, well, now there's also three gauge bosons, one of which would take three generators. Three gauge bosons corresponding to the three generators of SO3. One of those generators infinitesimally takes this BEV and rotates it this way. One of them takes it and rotates it this way, same directions as the scalar field directions I just drew. And there's a third one which just doesn't move this guy, but just rotates the whole sphere about this axis. You know, that there's the third generator of SO3 which just rotates the sphere around the x-axis. So that moves the sphere, but it doesn't move the BEV. This point stays fixed. Okay, so of those three generators, that one, which holds the VEV fixed and just rotates around the x-axis, that one will remain massless. So corresponding to this massive scalar field, we are going to have one massless vector boson, one vector boson which remains massless. On the other hand, corresponding to these two massless scalars in the original theory, these guys will both get eaten by the two corresponding generators that rotate us along these directions. So we'll end up getting two massive, those two generators will correspond to vector bosons that become massive. Oh, and by the way, there's something here that's going to be confusing if I don't point it out. So the fact that these two give two massive vectors, that's a general thing. The fact that we got a one in both of these plot spaces, that's just a coincidence in this example. These two numbers won't in general be the same. But the point is that there will be some massless vector fields which correspond to the vectors that don't transform the VEV, and in general, that'll be unrelated to this number. But in this case, these two numbers are going to always match, because every generator which moves the VEV will end up eating a massless scalar by the same process we just described. So anyway, that's the general mechanism. We'll have to apply it to the actual standard model the next time. But anyway, the components are in place. Any questions?
What does the word spontaneous mean there? Like, is there I always get confused by that.
Well, it just means that it's supposed to evoke the fact that even though the theory itself, the Lagrangian, has a symmetry. So it's supposed to be in contrast to explicitly broken symmetry. So you could have a theory that just didn't have any symmetry. You would call that explicitly broken. So you could add a term. Let's say I added a term to the Lagrangian here, which let's say I added a term to the potential here, which ended up lifting up the potential here so that it got higher and higher and higher, and it really did just have a unique minimum here. So then there would only be one vacuum. That would be called explicit symmetry break. I actually changed the Lagrangian so that it no longer had a symmetry. But what actually happens in spontaneous symmetry breaking is that the Lagrangian does have an honest-to-God symmetry. All of these vacua are all the same energy. None is any better than another. And so how does the universe decide to pick one over another? Well, spontaneously. There's no explanation for why it chooses one over another. It's supposed to evoke the fact that it just has to pick one, and so it does. But as soon as it does, it breaks the symmetry, because, you know, why didn't it choose this one? That's what it's supposed to mean. Okay, next time, applied to the standard model. Almost there.